This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community. This podcast is brought to you by Joy sponsor Pam Ann.
Hello, Melbourne. It's Pam Ann here. I'm so excited. I'm going to be touching down at the Comedy Theatre in August. See you soon. I love you, Melbourne. Mwah.
Set to land in Melbourne this August for two hilarious shows, Friday, August 24 and Saturday, August 25. Get your tickets now at ticketmaster.com.au.
Welcome to The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter. We are committed to bringing you the day's most important news and current affairs stories from an LGBTI perspective. If it matters to the LGBTI community, we will cover it. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS 0427 Joy 949 or email on air at joy.org.au or follow us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
It's Thursday, the 19th of April. Welcome to your nightly news and current affairs show, The Informer. I'm your host, Dean Arcurie.
And I'm Tom Morgan.
Tonight on the show, we explore how a recent study on fertility preservation amongst trans and non-binary Australians can actually provide a great module for engagement and collecting data in these communities to be able to find and build stronger support and knowledge.
With Newcastle Locals launching the inaugural Newcastle Pride Festival in August, we look at why we need to be more visible with our pride in regional spaces to create awareness and inclusion.
And with tomorrow night's Minus 18 Queer Formal in Melbourne, we speak to Lush Cosmetics, who have partnered with the event, about what it means to do so as a business. While some may assume it's all about the money, does this kind of visibility and inclusion create something stronger or more accepting for all?
This is The Informer, Joy's nightly news and current affairs program. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS us on 0427 Joy 949, email on air at joy.org.au or add us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
In last night's episode of The Informer, we heard from Dr. Damien Riggs, Associate Professor in Social Work at Flinders University and Project Leader in the Research into Fertility Preservation among Trans and Non-Binary Australians. We reported on their initial findings, which created a snapshot of the information sourced by the study with over 400 Australians surveyed.
With the summation details opening up a plethora of information data that can be shared on a range of topics relating to the study for trans and non-binary individuals, we began to discuss how they sought such a rich and diverse engagement through the study. The blueprint of this is a great way for people creating data and research in the non-binary, transgender and gender diverse field.
So we continue our conversation tonight with Dr. Damien Riggs, a psychotherapist who works with transgender adolescents and children, as we discuss his experiences engaging with these individuals on fertility options, experiences and concerns.
In addition to working at Flinders, I'm a psychotherapist and I work with transgender kids. And so part of the conversations I have with children as they approach puberty and may wish to start puberty blockers is about fertility preservation. And it's an unusual conversation to have because you don't normally talk to very young children about, do you want to have kids when you grow up? But it's part of what we need to do to make sure they have that option. And so it's always been on my radar, and then presenting at different conferences around this topic and sort of questioning, you know, how many people are actually doing it? We don't really know in Australia. We've got a little bit of international research. What does it look like in Australia? So that sort of led us to do this project. I think it is like a historical consequence that historically trans people were expected to undergo a range of surgeries that would mean they could no longer conceive children from their own gamete. And that was the norm. That was what was expected. And there was no choice around that. And I think as that has shifted, as, you know, and certainly only in the last decade, the possibility of storing gametes has been more widely available to trans people in Australia. But then people need to know that's available to ask for that service, unless they happen to work with a really inclusive service provider who says, oh, this is something you might like to think about. And that was, in a way, one of my entry points to this study, was knowing that as a clinician, I need to talk to young people about this, and I absolutely do that and believe in that. But worrying or wondering about what it means to say to a very young person before they start puberty blockers, do you want to store gametes, or for people who haven't started puberty, tissue, and in the possibility you might want kids in the future? And lots of people will say yes, because you're offering a possibility, and who knows what you want in the future. But my worry is about the cost. It costs a lot of money to do this. It's invasive, particularly for trans boys and for trans men. There's annual storage fees. And then, of course, we know that the longer you freeze gametes, the less likely they are to thaw successfully. So I'm, you know, always being careful about that this is a possibility you could undertake, but there's no promise that even something will come of it, even if you decide you want to. So that was my initial entry point, actually, into this project, was wanting to know how many people are wanting to do this so that we can make sure people are informed about the decisions they're making down the track.
While discussing the initial findings of their research into fertility preservation decision-making amongst trans and non-binary Australians, it seemed clear that for Dr. Damien Riggs, co-lead researcher of this study at Flinders University, this was not just about understanding the number of individuals who had engaged with fertility preservation information and services, but also to identify the ways in which individuals had been limited in their access. I asked Dr. Riggs if it appeared that the majority had been made aware of these options available to them, specifically by medical and fertility professionals.
That was something that we were really, I guess, in a way surprised by. Not that we thought everyone would know it was an option, but, you know, as a clinician myself, and I work according to the WPATH standards, which say we need to advise people this is an option, we need to create those pathways. I think I just thought that most people would have come in contact, because of the way gender transition is regulated in this country through medical professionals and mental health professionals, that people would have been exposed to this information. But I think partly it's probably a lack of professionals providing that information, and partly it's people saying, I don't want to be part of that system. I'm going to negotiate my own ways through gender transition, which may or may not involve hormones, may or may not involve surgery. And therefore, if you're not coming into contact with those professionals, you're not going to get the information. So that, I think, reflects a lot of research on, not primarily on the lives of transgender people around having kids, that we tend to see much lower rates of trans people having kids than we would expect from a population average. And there's lots of reasons around that. People prioritise transition over having children, which is totally reasonable. People don't see children as part of their life. They have other areas that they focus on in their life. No one's really looked into, actually, why people are less likely to have kids if they're trans or non-binary, but it's a common research finding that far fewer people do have children. So we had about a third of participants were men and about a third of participants were non-binary, and then the rest was distributed between mainly women and then a small number of agender people. So we had a decent spread of diversity across our sample. Something I'll have to think about when we go back and write this second paper from the data is maybe look at, for people who had said they wish they had or would have liked that to have been an option, was there reasoning around cost? Because we don't really have that data, and I don't think we really have that data internationally. We have data that says the cost is prohibitive, but we don't necessarily know whether people would have done it even if the cost wasn't prohibitive. So we're sort of operating on what seems to be the case, that lower numbers of people are wanting to do this than you would expect from the general population. But maybe cost is a really key factor in the whole thing.
I also discussed with Dr. Riggs what, beyond the issue of cost and interest in biological children, could be done to improve the experiences and outcomes for trans and non-binary Australians to engage with fertility services and options going forward.
I think there's a knowledge, perhaps, limitation, and we're going to do another separate different study later, starting later this year, that's part of an international study. And part of that, it's primarily on trans men and reproduction, but we're also going to talk to reproductive health professionals. And what do they know about working with trans people in reproductive areas? What do they understand? What kind of inclusion do they offer? What kind of language do they use? So I think certainly the clinical capacity there is in terms of, you know, the practices, the techniques, but whether people would go along to those services and feel welcomed and feel included, that's another question. I think it's an interesting topic, and people know that this kind of question hasn't really been asked before in Australia. I think it's also around the idea, having, you know, spent almost a decade now doing research with trans people on trans trans people's experiences, it is a slow burn, I think, and it should be a slow burn, because we have to prove we can be trusted if we're not transgender, and I'm not. We have to show that the research we do is fair and reasonable and inclusive. It doesn't contribute to anti-trans and anti-non-binary sentiment. And I think it takes time to trust people. And I think, you know, researchers and clinicians have done a lot of crappy things to trans and non-binary communities in the past and still in the present. And so I think it's really reasonable that over time we have built up trust as a research team, and that our research is seen as useful and trustworthy. And I think that's certainly our agenda, is to keep building that trust and to keep researching topics that people tell us are interesting and that they want to know more about, and not be led by random ideas we might have what could be a useful topic. There's like absolutely three prongs to it to us. There's one is community information, so that people know this is an option. There's one is about educating professionals so that they're aware of barriers. And the third is about, under the current WPATH standards, we're encouraged to suggest this to people and give people advice, but it's a very brief couple of pages in a very long document. There's a new version hopefully coming out in the next year or so. Hopefully this will also inform that around how do we have these conversations, rather than just you should have the conversations with clients. How do we talk about it? Do we use a desire for genetic relatedness to be a way we have the conversation? Do we acknowledge that non-binary people have very specific experiences and needs? So it's also about informing that clinical work as well.
That was Tom Morgan with Dr. Damien Riggs.
There is still more to come on Joy's The Informer, the news program from an LGBTI perspective.
Newcastle is the second most populated area in New South Wales, and the local LGBTI community have decided that it's time to stand with pride and have created the inaugural Newcastle Pride Festival to take place in August.
Dean Arcurie spoke with Ivan Skanes, one of the organisers of Newcastle Pride Incorporated, about the need for a pride event in the area and the fact that while we may have marriage equality, we still don't have acceptance.
My colleague Lee and I are bringing together the festival with the help from other members of the community. It's early days in terms of getting together an organisation, but we've just incorporated and we're looking for assistance from community members.
In February, Newcastle's Gateway Hotel announced that it was time for a change of direction. After 18 years of being an LGBTIQ venue, it was time for a change of name and a change of focus on live music from March. There was a strong outcry from the local community about the need for the change, asking where the LGBTIQ locals will go now that they don't have a space to call their own.
The formation of Newcastle Pride as an organisation and the commencement of the annual Newcastle Pride Festival was an idea of my colleague Leanne McDougall, and she noticed that there was a venue in Newcastle that was very much a safe place for the queer community, and that had been sold and that was no longer the case. And she also thought that the milestone of the marriage equality was a good thing to celebrate, and that now was a good time to hold a pride festival, because there are other things that still need to be done.
Newcastle's local LGBTI community was fast running out of options to meet up, network and celebrate. So this week, when it was announced that there were 3 days of Pride in August with a fair day, dance party and more, it was a great way to hit the ground running and to be able to build something special for everyone to engage with at Newcastle Pride.
It's very important to note that Newcastle Pride and the starting off of the Newcastle Pride Festival isn't the first time that a major community event has occurred in Newcastle. We've had previous organisations, previous groups, including a group that I was involved in called Rainbow Visions Hunter, and we operated quite successfully in Newcastle and the Hunter from about 2001 till about 2011 or 12. It's just that for the last few years, there's been a little bit of a hiatus in queer community events in the area. It's very much about community engagement, and although our focus is at the moment the staging of the Newcastle Pride Festival over the 24th to 26th weekend in August, there's no doubt that other opportunities and initiatives will come our way as time goes by. So, as happens with lots of community events, whether that's health or community development or social events, no doubt that they'll flow out of this first festival. A weekend festival or a 10-day festival has been our experience in the past. So it's not as if we've never run an event or a festival like this. And so in some ways we're using our knowledge and our experience from previous events. Certainly, we only wanted to make it one weekend, not longer than that, because we're very aware of what we can manage. But I think the events we've chosen are quite usual events for a festival, for want of a better word. So a launch combined with a film night, and then a picnic or a fair day, whatever groups might call that, and then a dance. So they're the core elements, but we're certainly looking to partner to other individuals and organisations for events that might be allied to the festival. I think that's how we can maintain our commitment to a manageable level, but also incorporate other events as well. We're trying to build something special, yes, for the Newcastle community, but we certainly are keen for it to be wider. Newcastle is the capital of the whole Hunter region. And so, although no doubt at this stage the focus is Newcastle, we're specifically partnering with one event that's going to take people on a tour to the Hunter Vineyards. So our focus is certainly wider than just Newcastle by itself.
Everyone will be welcome at events no matter how they identify. And with the closure of the gateway, there was outcry for somewhere for people to feel accepted. We may think after last year's yes vote that we don't need to keep creating spaces such as this. But if you take one look at Newcastle Herald's Facebook page when the story was announced this week, you'll see plenty of need to create a space where Newcastle's LGBTIQ communities can feel accepted.
Although we've seen a successful vote for the yes to marriage equality, it's very obvious from some readings I was doing today that the battle isn't over. So on the local newspaper Facebook page, the Newcastle Herald Facebook page, I made the mistake of reading through comments about the story that appeared in the Newcastle Herald from community people. And there's still a lot of opposition and still a lot of concern about special events for different diverse groups. And so I think there's certainly things that need to be done. And we're seeing this as a positive step to engage with those people who are within the community, but also allies of ours in the wider community.
If you'd like to get involved, lend support or be part of Newcastle's inaugural Pride event in August, just get in touch with Newcastle Pride Incorporated, that's Newcastle Pride Inc., via Facebook and say hello.
We're looking for people to be involved in this festival in a whole range of ways. At the very basic level, we're keen on members of our community talking to their friends, their relatives, their colleagues at work about the festival and spreading the word that it's on, right through to people to help organise the events, and also for sponsors to be involved in supporting the festival through either cash contributions or in-kind support. I'm from the country. I live in a rural area, inland from Newcastle. And so personally, I'm very keen for this festival to engage not only the Newcastle folk, but people from throughout the Hunter region.
That was Dean Arcuri with Ivan Skeynes from the Newcastle Pride Incorporated.
This is The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter.
In February, on Valentine's Day, Lush Cosmetics launched a Pride campaign celebrating the vibrant and powerful LGBTQIA+ community within their own business, a business which visibly shows support for its LGBTIQA+ staff during last year's postal survey and support for our communities as well.
This Friday, Minus 18 will hold the first Queer Formal of 2018 in Melbourne, with 500 young people celebrating who they are in a formal event where they can be who they are and proudly bring their friends and partners as they hold their hands and dance the night away.
Lush Cosmetics has partnered with Minus 18 to help make this year's first Queer Formal happen. Dean Arcuri spoke to Ariane, Lush's charitable communications specialist, about why this kind of visibility and inclusion was important for their business in creating a strong and accepting space for all.
The Pride Feb campaign was a campaign that we launched really just as an opportunity to celebrate the really strong, dynamic LGBT community that we have within our own staff. It was launched around the same time as Mardi Gras, which we're a yearly sponsor of, and also Auckland Pride in New Zealand. So it just ran throughout February as a way to, yeah, celebrate our staff and our customers, but also to support different charities in Australia and New Zealand focused on different LGBTQI issues. Most of our campaigns do start from our staff or our customers telling us what they're passionate about and what they think that we should be commenting on. But Lush has actually been campaigning on LGBTQI issues for probably the last 5 or 6 years. So in 2013, we ran the Sign of Love campaign. And then in 2015, we launched a global campaign, which was called Gay is Okay. And that was designed to raise awareness around how in 73 countries around the world, it was still illegal to be gay. So we launched that as a global campaign. And then we've always used that Valentine's Day as an opportunity to present a broader, more realistic image of what love looks like. So we've always used our staff in the windows, and we've always tried to represent real LGBTQI couples. So the Pride campaign kind of came after we'd been heavily involved in the marriage equality debate in Australia. Our Post Yes campaign became the longest running cause-related campaign that we've had in our stores to date. And after that, you know, horrific, turbulent time for the LGBT community, we thought it was just a really great opportunity to celebrate our LGBT community within our staff and our customers, and just, yeah, celebrate how important it is to be prideful and to love yourself.
Their last Pride campaign featured 11 Lush staff members across 43 shop windows in Australia and New Zealand, with these staff members sharing stories and experiences of sexuality and gender. I asked Ariane what this kind of visible inclusiveness meant to their business. While many see businesses supporting our communities in the past 6 months as a strong show of support, some can't help but feel it's tokenism. And while it's easy to look at a retail business and assume that they're going for our dollar, does this kind of visibility mean something more?
Campaigning was really ingrained in Lush right from the very beginning. The business was created by animal and environmental activists. There's been these core values just in our everyday business. So when we do campaign on an issue, or we do align ourselves with a value and a community, it's just something that we continue to do daily. So as I mentioned, we do have a really strong LGBTQI community within our own staff, and they ignite a lot of the campaigning and the donations and stuff that we do to support issues within that area. For us, it's just kind of a given. It's just us supporting our staff and our customers and just really hearing what their needs are and just representing them in the best possible way, I guess. I mean, business has so much power in creating social change, and I think if you use that power for good, it's so important.
This year, Lush are supporting -18's Queer Youth Formal, a place where young queer people and their friends can be their true self. They can take a lovely date, arrive with their besties, and meet like-minded, wonderful queer folk. And on an even more fabulous note, all tickets to this year's Queer Formal were free, thanks to the amazing people that donated to the -18 Queer Formal crowdfunding campaign.
We worked with -18 through our Pride campaign, so they were one of the charities that we donated funding to from that campaign. And we've also worked with them on a smaller scale in the past, where some local stores have held charity pot events with them. But in this kind of capacity, through our charity pot program, we have funded -18 in holding the Queer Formal. So our charity pot program is a grant initiative that we have that supports grassroots organisations that are working within the areas of animal welfare, human rights and environmental protection. So through this program, we really seek to fund projects that might often struggle to find funding elsewhere. And those that are focused on education, sustainability, and they're really working to change the attitudes and practices that cause discrimination. So for us, the Queer Formal is just a really beautiful combination of all of those things. And we believe that it's such an important event to support and just totally support the work that -18 is doing. And then we're also donating some product to the Formal as well. So the attendees will be receiving some Lush product, and there's a little bit of an activation going on there with some of our own staff.
Over the past 2 years, both -18 and the Queer Formals have come under attack from fringe groups and fringe politicians trying to create a platform for themselves at the expense of young LGBTIQA+ people. So it's great to not just see a business like this standing up and showing their support, but really getting behind the event and raising funds within their organisations, as well as awareness of the need to create a valid and open space for young people to be themselves, however they identify.
Everything we do, we try to do it holistically. So alongside the campaigns that we run in our stores, we're always donating money to charities that are also working on the same issue. We will continue to support events and members of the community where we can, because we don't believe in kind of picking up an issue and then dropping it. We're going to support change until we see it through. So, yeah, this is just another step in that.
Tomorrow night, 500 young people will be celebrating being exactly who they are in Melbourne at the Queer Formal. And thanks to the generous donation of Minus 18 alumni, past attendees and the community, they're able to hold a second free Queer Formal in Sydney this year, which means 1,000 free tickets are already sold, as well as having a third Queer Formal on the way in Adelaide later in the year. You can support young LGBTIQA plus Australians being themselves at any of these Queer Formals by heading to minus18.org.au.
On behalf of Lush Australia and New Zealand, a massive shout out to everyone attending the Queer Formal. Have a fantastic night, enjoy celebrating your identity and be proud of who you are.
That was Dina Curie with Ariane, Lush Cosmetics Charitable Communications Specialist.
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.
That's it for another episode of The Informer, bringing you news and current affairs for Australia's LGBTI communities. A podcast of tonight's Informer will be available to download soon at joy.org.au or on your preferred podcast platform.
Don't forget to follow us on social media at The Informer on Joy 94.9 on Facebook and at The Informer Joy on Twitter.
If you have a story or tip that you'd like to share with us, get in touch at theinformer@joy.org.au. I'm Dina Curie.
I'm Tom.
You've been listening to The Informer on Joy 94.9.
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.